Luke chapter 5 and verse 27. After this, that's after Jesus just healed a paralyzed man and astonished everybody, Jesus went out and saw a tax collector named Levi sitting at the tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me." And leaving everything, he rose and followed him. And Levi made him a feast in his house, and there was a large company of tax collectors and others reclining at the table with them. And the Pharisees and their scribes grumbled at Jesus' disciples, saying, "Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?" And Jesus answered them, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I haven't come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance." And they said to him, "The disciples of John fast often and offer prayers, and so do the disciples of the Pharisees, but yours eat and drink." And Jesus said to them, "Can you make wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and they'll fast in those days." He also told them a parable. "No one tears a piece from a new garment and puts it on an old garment. If he does, he'll tear the new, and the piece from the new will not match the old. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the new wine will burst the skins, and it will be spilled, and the skins will be destroyed. But new wine must be put into fresh wineskins. And no one, after drinking old wine, desires new, for he says the old is good." On a Sabbath, while Jesus was going through the cornfields, his disciples plucked and ate some ears of corn, rubbing them in their hands. But some of the Pharisees said, "Why are you doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath?" Jesus answered them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and took and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat, and also gave it to those with him? And he said to them, 'The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath.' On another Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching, and a man was there whose right hand was withered. And the scribes and the Pharisees watched him to see whether he would heal on the Sabbath, so that they might find a reason to accuse him. But he knew their thoughts, and he said to the man with the withered hand, 'Come here and stand here.' And he rose and stood there. And Jesus said to them, 'I ask you, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to destroy it?' And after looking around at them all, he said to him, 'Stretch out your hand.' And he did so, and his hand was restored. But they were filled with fury and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus." Well, so there's an outline on the inside of your service sheet that you might find helpful. And I've called the outline "How It All Went Sour." At least that's the introduction. How did it all go sour? Because just look at the end of last week's passage, chapter 5, verse 26. Amazement seized them all. They glorified God and were filled with awe, saying, "We've seen extraordinary things today." And then look at the end of today's passage, chapter 6, verse 11. They were filled with fury and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. Last week, they're praising God, glorifying God. This week, they want to kill Jesus. What's happened? Like, how come that the honeymoon period, as they say, has ended so abruptly? What has Jesus done or said that's turned people so completely against him? They loved him just a couple of days ago, and now they want to kill him. Well, I don't know about you, but I've been watching The Crown season 5. I asked people downstairs whether they'd seen The Crown. They immediately looked very nervous, lest I was about to give a spoiler. So I'm not going to give a spoiler. I'm only going to say what's been in the headlines of the papers this last week. But I've watched a bit too much of it, considering it only came out like last week. But anyway, The Crown season 5, it's not a surprise to know that this is the Charles and Diana season. I mean, basically, most of the episodes are about them. And that's no surprise because, I mean, you know that that was the big story of the monarchy back in those times. And I quite like the way it's portrayed, because I thought it might be sort of really anti-King Charles, King Charles, who'd rejected his first wife and driven her to mental health crises. And, you know, I thought it might sort of demonize him. But actually, it seemed to me anyway that it was quite evenly balanced. And you realize that King Charles had made some mistakes, or as he was then, the Prince of Wales had made some mistakes. But also that Lady Diana was quite a difficult character. Princess Diana was tricky as well. And it was a sort of, it's quite two-sided. And there's two sides to every story. And I thought there's a points where you sort of sympathize with Prince Charles and points where you sympathize with Princess Diana. And, you know, I thought at least it was quite a balanced picture. Maybe you don't think it's balanced because you take one of those sides. You think that one of the two of them was to blame. Certainly within the episode, you find that various people in Britain side with one or the other, or at least the sympathy flips between the two. Everyone's on King Charles's side, and then Princess Diana does an interview, and then everyone's on her side, and then it flips back and forth. And there's two sides to the Charles and Diana divorce. There's two sides to the crown, actually. I mean, some people love it and have praised it, and some people hate it. So Judi Dench, the famous actress, she hated it. She wanted them to put a disclaimer at the beginning to say this is fictionalized history. She took great exception to some of it. In her letter to the Times, she said it's both cruelly unjust to the individuals and damaging to the institution they represent. No one's a greater believer in artistic freedom than I, but this cannot go unchallenged. So two sides to the Charles versus Di, two sides to the crown, two sides to every story, maybe. Two sides to the, let me just pick some more controversial ones. Two sides to the last US election. Did Biden win, or was the election stolen from Trump? Now, I think we all agree with one version of that, but a sizable proportion of America think otherwise. Two sides to every story. Two sides to the war in Ukraine. Again, I think pretty much everyone here will have one view about the invasion and attack on innocent people. But a sizable portion of Russia think otherwise. Now, at that point, you kind of think, well, yeah, there's two sides to the story, but they're not both valid, are they? That's the point. There's the spin side. There's the crazy minority who still believes something, absurd side. And then there's what every reasonable person should think. Well, I think that's a helpful sort of way of beginning to look at these verses, because there's two sides here to Jesus. There's the pro-Jesus side, there's those who follow him and love him and choose to put their whole life into his hands. And there's others who grumble at him and reject him. And of course, that's true not only at the time of Jesus, it's true even now when you ask people about Jesus. Some people love him. I guess there's lots of those people here disproportionately. Others are indifferent to him. Others are outright opposed to him. Two sides to every story. But are both those sides equally valid? Or is one of them the true, objective, honest-minded response, and others end up being coloured by an agenda and by a group that we'd have no sympathy with? Well, I think part of the reason for this part of Luke's narrative is Luke wants to show us how the two sides came about so that we can decide which verdict we follow. Do you think Jesus is great news, or do you think he's trouble? Probably most of us think he's great news. And you might think, if you think he's trouble, if you're a skeptic today, you might think, well, look, Luke, of course, is biased, isn't he? Because Luke is writing this account. He's a Christian. I mean, he's a follower of Jesus. So this is like reading the account of the US election by a Trump supporter, maybe. Or it's like reading about the war in Ukraine from the Russian state news. I mean, why should I trust an account about Jesus written by a Christian? Because surely he's not going to be objective. And yeah, that might be a fair criticism, but I don't think you should reject Luke out of hand just because he believed the things that he writes. Whenever people make this objection to me, they say you can't trust the Bible because it's written by Christians. I always say you can't trust medical textbooks because they're written by doctors. You know, the doctors who write these medical textbooks, they believe them. Yeah, sure. I mean, Luke does believe it. That doesn't by itself mean he's biased or dishonest. We just got to look at his reasons why. What reasons does Luke give us for Jesus' credibility? And what reasons does he have to be suspicious of those who reject him? So I've just got 2 points, and there, one is on the side of why Jesus is great, and the other one is on the side of why people think he's not great. So we're listening to the sort of pro-Jesus side first, and then the anti-Jesus side second. That's the plan. So you'll see 2 points. Number one, Jesus is the Son of Man who brings repentance for the forgiveness of sins and Sabbath rest. That's quite a big mouthful, but I'm going to go through it in stages. Jesus is the Son of Man who brings repentance for the forgiveness of sins and Sabbath rest. This passage tells us who Jesus is, and it tells us what he's come to do. Well, the biggest bombshell that Jesus has dropped so far about who he is comes from this title, he is the Son of Man. It actually came in last week's passage for the first time in Luke's gospel. Jesus was having a conversation with some people about whether he could forgive sins. And he says, I can, because the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. And we looked at that last week. If you were here, you remember. If you weren't here, it's Jesus taking on his own lips a title from the Old Testament prophets. That's probably the greatest title ever given to a human being. In the prophet Daniel, God had said that one like a Son of Man, a human being, would be brought into the presence of God, the Ancient of Days, and would be given all of God's power, authority, and dominion over the nations. Everyone would worship this character, serve this character, in the same way that they serve God himself. And we saw last week that this goes way above what would be appropriate for any kind of king on earth. Really, God is sharing his own glory, his own godness with this character. And in fact, you know, you're forced to the conclusion that this Son of Man is not only a human king, but really he's a divine king as well. He shares the very glory and power and dominion of God himself. And so it's a little glimpse in the Old Testament of the Trinity that God the Father shares with this king and God the Son, all of his godness. Well, Jesus takes on that title, I am the Son of Man. And if they know their prophets, they should realize what an amazing thing Jesus is saying. God is amongst you. The one with all of God's authority is amongst you. And then in these passages, he just sort of multiplies titles. Not only is he the Son of Man, but he's the bridegroom, verse 35. So they're saying, how come you don't fast? How come you don't do without food for the sake of your prayers? Because we've noticed that the really sincere religious people, namely John the Baptist disciples and our disciples, they like to do without food in order to really pray. And I noticed that your disciples are just feasting all the time. That doesn't seem very religious or pious, Jesus. And Jesus goes, well, of course they're feasting because the bridegroom's here. This is a wedding. You might fast for religious reasons, but you don't fast during weddings. Well, I am the bridegroom and I'm with my people. And so, of course, they feast. Now, again, this is a massive Old Testament title. In the Old Testament, God had said that he would be like a bridegroom to his people. He would be their husband. They would be his bride. So Jesus, again, is effectively saying, I am God come to be in relationship with my people. Of course, people are rejoicing. And then when they get a bit snippy about Jesus' disciples plucking ears of corn on the Sabbath, and they say, oh, I'm not sure this is quite right to do on the Sabbath on a Saturday, you know, because that you're not supposed to harvest or work on Saturdays. Now, there's all sorts of answers Jesus could give to this. He could say, we're not harvesting, we're just snacking. You know, because the Old Testament law says on the Sabbath day, you keep it holy and you're not to do any work. They're not exactly doing work, are they? They're just walking through the field, just picking up a munching like that. And they go, look, you're working. We're not working. We're just snacking. It's like being cross with someone for sucking a polo on a Saturday. Now, this isn't labor. He's just enjoying the goodness of polos, or enjoying, in this case, the organic goodness of little bits of corn that you can snack on as you walk through the field. Jesus could say, don't be so ridiculous in your interpretation of the Old Testament law. Don't be so pernickety. But instead, Jesus ups the ante and says, well, King David did, didn't he? King David did something that you would consider to be unlawful when he ate the special holy bread. And so that's why my disciples are also enjoying God's goodness. Now, this is a tricky little episode. We had it read earlier. I don't think Jesus is saying King David broke the law and I'm allowed to break the law as well. Jesus isn't saying I'm above the law. Actually, if you look at the instructions in the law about the showbread, or the bread that was kept before the Lord in the tabernacle, it doesn't actually say that it's prohibited for anyone but priests to eat. It just says positively, priests can eat it. It doesn't say priests can eat it and don't you dare otherwise eat it. But I guess it was the sort of understanding that ordinarily speaking, this bread would be for priests. But there was a time in David's life when he was on the run and extremely hungry and starving. And so being the rightful king elect, being the anointed one, he took some of that bread and ate it. Now, of course, no Jewish Pharisee could really have a problem with that, because this was King David, the greatest ever king. And Jesus, you know, your kind of extremely narrow view of the law would put even King David offside. And you'd make exceptions for King David, wouldn't you? Or therefore make exceptions for me. So Jesus, like when you see a sign in, I don't know if you went to see with what the crown analogy on my mind. If you go to one of those Buckingham Palace tours and it says, keep off the grass, and you boldly go and walk on the grass and say, what are you doing walking on the grass? And you say, well, I've noticed that King Charles III walks on the grass, and say, so do I. Now, of course, the prohibition, keep off the grass, is not absolute. It means keep off the grass, you punters, keep off the grass ordinarily. But, you know, the king's allowed to. And you say, well, the king's allowed to, so I'm doing it. That's what Jesus is kind of saying. So in this passage, he's just assuming massive authority. I'm the son of man of the prophets, the God-man king. I'm the bridegroom, God come to be in relationship with his people. I'm like King David himself. And you ought to interpret the law relative to what your great heroes have done, not according to your rabbis. Jesus is saying he is someone amazing, but then he's saying he does something amazing. And we saw a bit of this last week. Jesus said he's come to forgive sins. And he says something similar this week in chapter 5, verse 32. So Jesus calls as one of his first followers a man called Levi. He's a tax collector. This tax collector becomes a disciple of Jesus. This tax collector invites lots of other tax collector friends and other sinners round to dinner with Jesus. And people are a bit scandalized. Now, for tax collector, don't think civil servant. You know, somebody who worked hard and was good at maths and got a job on the civil service fast track. Think instead Jewish traitor working for Roman occupiers. Here's a country where they don't have liberty. The Roman occupying forces march the streets. The soldiers come in every now and then. And they tax people very unpopularly, because this isn't tax to the Jewish rulership. This is tax going to the puppet King Herod and to the Romans. And so people deeply resent this tax. It would be like, I guess, Putin taxing Ukrainians in Crimea or in the disputed territories. I mean, he's not welcome there, but yet he's imposing taxes to a foreign tyrant. And imagine some local people volunteering to collect taxes for Putin. People would hate them. That's the kind of idea here. This is Jewish people offering to collect taxes on behalf of Herod and the Romans. So despised traitors. Jesus is having dinner with despised traitors. And despised traitors don't really find it very easy to make friends. The only people that they, I guess, can make friends with is other despised traitors and people at the very margins of society who are, for other reasons, scandalous. So Levi's mates are other tax collectors and sinners. Jesus hangs out with them for dinner. People are very concerned about this. Jesus wouldn't expect you to hang out with people like that. And Jesus explains, verse 31, Those who are well don't need a doctor, but those who are sick. I haven't come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. Jesus comes, despised traitors are exactly the kind of people I've come for. And prostitutes and adulterers and idolaters and liars and murderers. And yeah, they're the people who, spiritually speaking, really need help. I've come for them. Jesus is the one who forgives sins. Jesus is the one who comes to treat sinners. And then Jesus, the one who calls sinners to repentance. Now, one of the weird things about this point in Grace Church Greenwich is that we're studying Mark's gospel, many of us, in our small groups on Wednesdays and in Sunday school downstairs. And we're studying Luke's gospel up here on a Sunday morning. Now, I don't know whether you're finding that confusing. I am. So you get, no, that's what Mark said about this. And this is what Luke's said about this. And God has given us four accounts of Jesus' life, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, not just one. And right at the moment, by looking at two in parallel, I think it kind of focuses you on the particular things that Luke wants to emphasize compared with Mark. Now, I think in all likelihood, Mark's gospel was written first. And Luke, when he wrote his gospel, had access to Mark, but then added in some extra stuff. So Luke, you know, knew the Apostle Paul and hung about with the early Christians. So he had access to lots of the eyewitnesses. But one of the eyewitnesses that he had access to was Mark. So So what changes has Luke decided to make to Mark's narrative? Which things has he decided to emphasize or to underline? Well, here's the first one. In Mark's gospel, you might remember, Jesus says, "I haven't come to call the righteous, but sinners," full stop. And then Luke just wants to clarify that a bit and just adds in, "I haven't come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance." Forgiveness of sins and repentance from sins. And in Luke's gospel, he keeps putting those two together. He wants us to know that the thing Jesus has come to do is to forgive us, to release us from all the things we've done wrong, and yet also to call for change, for us to turn around. The word repentance just means to change your mind. He wants people to be forgiven, and he wants people to change their mind about God and about how they live. And it's particularly distinctive of Luke's gospel, I think, that we keep seeing those two things together. In fact, right at the end of Luke's gospel, when Jesus summarizes the Christian gospel that's got to go to all nations, he says the Christ had to suffer and rise from the dead and repentance for the forgiveness of sins must be preached to all nations. That's what Jesus come to do. He's the King, the Bridegroom, the Son of Man. He's come to bring repentance for the forgiveness of sins. Tax collectors can be forgiven, but tax collectors have got to change. Murderers can be forgiven. Murderers have got to change. Idolaters, adulterers, liars, whoever we were before we were Christians, we can be forgiven, but we've got to change. Repentance and forgiveness. And then lastly, Jesus came to bring Sabbath rest. So Jesus on Saturday does all sorts of controversial things. He allows his disciples to snack, if we look at that. But also he does healings. Again, the Pharisees are very upset because they think you're not supposed to do work on Saturdays. And Jesus disagrees. He says, yeah, you can't work. That's what the law said. But I can heal. I can rescue, I can save on Saturdays. And he actually puts them the question, verse 9. I ask you, is it lawful on the Sabbath, on a Saturday, to do good or to do harm, to save life or to destroy it? Yeah, you've got your particular rabbinic debates about what's allowed on the Sabbath, but let's just make it really simple. Let's turn it to a simple moral question. Is it right on a Saturday to save people or to kill people? To do good to people or to do harm to people? That ought to be quite an easy moral question. It's better to save people
It's better to do good to people. But it's not just that, you know, that's a sort of exception. You shouldn't do work on a Saturday unless you're saving people or helping people. I think that's true, by the way. That's quite a good exception, I think, is that there's good reasons for Christians to keep a Sabbath. And if you want to hear more about that, Andrew and I did a series on the Ten Commandments. And I think Andrew's sermon on the Sabbath was super, super helpful. It's a really good idea for Christians to take a Sabbath. But I'm glad that not all of the doctors in the A&E ward do. Or at least they have another day off instead. Hopefully, although with current medical hours, it's a bit stretched. But, you know, of course, if you're saving life, there might be an exception that, yeah, please, you can work on a Sunday. But the rest of us, it's good if we can to take a day off. Or if you're a shift worker, to find a day elsewhere in the week. It could just be partly that medical exemption. But I think there's more to it than that. And we find out later in Luke's gospel, it's not just that there's an exception that you can save people on a Saturday. But it's kind of particularly appropriate that you do so. Because what the Sabbath was meant to be wasn't just certainly wasn't meant to be a straitjacket of you mustn't. It was meant to be a day of blessing where you rested from your work to remember God's salvation. In the Ten Commandments, in the book of Deuteronomy, God explains that you should take a day off, one in seven, to remember how the Lord has rescued you. And so Jesus, to do rescuing on the rescue day, it's kind of the best day to do it of all. And Jesus has more to say about this later in the gospel. So, on the Jesus side, he's making incredible claims. The divine human king, the Son of Man. The bridegroom come to be in relationship with his people. The king like David. And he's come to do amazing things, to bring forgiveness and change, and even to bring rescue on the rescue day, as a kind of anticipation of the final Sabbath, which is the way that the Bible talks about our future hope of a new creation, of a world made new. On the rescue day, Jesus does the rescuing. That's from Jesus' side. Let's look at the Pharisees' side. And here is the thing about these sort of two sides to every story. It's actually the very same things that make Jesus so attractive that make Jesus so impossible for them. The same things that we love about Jesus are the things that they hate about Jesus. They hate that he claims to be the Son of Man. They think it's blasphemous. They hate that he comes to bring forgiveness to tax collectors. They think it's debased. And they hate that on the Sabbath he heals people. And as we look at it, I want us to see that their objections are disingenuous, hypocritical, and in fact, in the end, evil. So let's look at them in turn, those same things. Well, they grumble at Jesus' friendship with tax collectors and sinners because, well, why do you think they do? Why do you think they've got a problem with Jesus offering forgiveness to people and repentance to people? Why would you have a problem with that? And then as you look at the passage, there's various clues. It might just be they're surprised at the company he keeps. You know, like if I spent all of my spare time with I don't know how you'd find them in London, but a bunch of pro-Putin war in Ukraine supporters. And it turns out that was my dinner parties was mostly those kind of people. You'd be a bit surprised, probably. And you'd be asking questions. So it might just be that this is a valid question to ask Jesus. It might be that it's just Jesus too radical and too new. So he has this little saying about, well, when new wine comes along or when a new patch of cloth comes along, you can't just sort of fit it into your old wineskins or into your old garment. You've got to deal with something new in a new way. It might just be that the pace of change is too quick for them. You know, that's to give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they have valid concerns. Maybe they can't quite cope with how radical Jesus is. But actually, as time goes on in Luke's gospel, we find that the reason is quite different. The reason that they're annoyed with Jesus being friends with tax collectors and sinners is because they think that they're not in that category. You know, we're not sinners, Jesus. We're very righteous people. Why are you hanging out with lowlifes like them? They consider themselves to be morally superior, to be whiter than white. And so they look down on Jesus being friends with those in the gutter. That's how they regard it. And we, in the summer, we did a bunch of snapshots of Christians in the 18th century. And maybe you came along to one or two of them. And one of them was on George Whitefield. Was that you, Nathan? I can't remember. That was me. It was me, yeah. Okay, I forgot. Anyway, I'm allowed to steal the quote then because I'm stealing it for myself. But one of my favorite quotes about George Whitefield, you did the Countess of Huntingdon, that's why. And I left this quote for you, I remember. So George Whitefield, one of his sponsors was a very wealthy aristocrat called the Countess of Huntingdon. And she put all of her money into sponsoring his preaching. But one of my favorite quotes, and Nathan used it in his summer fellowship, is from one of her, one of the Countess of Huntingdon's friends who she'd invited to hear George Whitefield preach. And this friend was the Duchess of Buckingham, who lived in what is now Buckingham Palace. Everything today is about the crown. But anyway, and she writes to the Countess of Huntingdon saying, "I thank your ladyship for your invitation to attend the Methodist preachers. Their doctrines are most repulsive, being strongly tinctured with impertinence in their perpetual endeavor to level all rank and do away with all distinction. It's a monstrous thing to be told that your heart is as wicked as the common wretches that crawl on the ground. And I must say, I'm surprised that your ladyship would entertain such ideas so much at variance with good breeding." I love that quote. It's like it is the snootiest letter ever received. But what she's saying is, I despise Methodism because it's preaching to people in the gutter, sinners, social outcasts, tax collectors. And I certainly do not need that, being a duchess. That's the kind of extreme snootiness that I think the Pharisees are guilty of. Because again and again in the gospel, we find in Luke's gospel, these two groups, the tax collectors and sinners who love Jesus and the Pharisees who hate him. And I've put the references there. You see, they keep going head to head in chapter 7, in chapter 15, in chapter 18. And as it goes on, it becomes clear that the Pharisees, they considered themselves to be healthy. Jesus says the healthy don't need a doctor, but only the sick. And so they sort of despise Jesus hanging out with those who are morally diseased. But the irony is they're just blind to their own sicknesses and their own moral diseases. They end up being hypocrites. They don't want Jesus to forgive these people because they don't realize that they need to be forgiven themselves. There's a kind of self-righteousness that despises a message of forgiveness. I certainly don't need that. I've lived a very good life. I don't expect God to be kind to people who haven't been as good as me. And that self-righteousness causes contempt for Jesus' ministry. And not only are they self-righteous, but they're also hypocrites. And they're cross with Jesus for working on the Sabbath as they see it. But actually, Jesus keeps coming back to this episode, this issue of the Sabbath. And it's maybe you can just turn over to chapter 13. In chapter 13, verse 14, Jesus again heals a woman on the Sabbath and people glorify God. But the ruler of the synagogue, indignant because Jesus healed on the Sabbath, said to the people, "There are 6 days in which work ought to be done. Come on those days and be healed, not on the Sabbath day." And the Lord answered him, "You hypocrites, doesn't each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or donkey from the manger and lead it away to water it? And ought not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, and whose Satan has bound for 18 years, be loosed from the bond on the Sabbath day?" I think we've got Gerald here today. He's a vet. Where's Gerald? Somewhere. You're in the room. Does your veterinary surgery open on Sundays for emergencies? Yeah, okay. So, I mean, we look after even animals on Sundays, on Saturdays. Jesus goes, "Yeah, rightly so. And you won't let me help a woman?" a daughter of Abraham on a Saturday. He's like, what hypocrisy is this? That you care about your chihuahuas. And I suppose in those days, it probably wasn't small animals, was it? It was, you care about your sheep or your cows, your oxen, but I'm not allowed to care about a woman. Hypocrites. And you think, okay, by then they take the stinging rebuke. But it turns out that they still don't get it. Chapter 14, verse 1. One Sabbath, when he went to dine at the house of a ruler of the Pharisees, guess they're happier with that than him hanging out with tax collectors and sinners. At least now Jesus having a dinner party with one of them. But they were watching him carefully, and behold, there was a man before him who had dropsy, particular medical condition. And Jesus responded to the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? It's the same question he asked in chapter 6, and they still can't answer it. He took him and healed him and sent him away. And he said to them, which of you, having a son or an oxen that's fallen to a well on a Sabbath day, will not immediately pull him out? And they could not reply to these things. You see, it looks all so high-minded, doesn't it? We're very careful, Jesus, about the Sabbath commandment. Jesus goes, no, you're not. You're just complete hypocrites. You help your animals on Saturdays, and I can't help people on Saturdays. And they won't learn the lesson. And this ought to be the simplest of all moral questions. Tell me this, is it better on Saturdays to do good or to do harm? To save life or to kill? It's the same question in chapter 6, and it comes up again in chapter 14, and they still can't answer it because their opposition to Jesus is just a kind of pig-headed opposition. They just don't like him because they don't think they need the forgiveness that he offers. And they make excuses for opposing him, which they don't even live up to themselves. Two sides to every story, maybe. Some people love Jesus because he offers them forgiveness and change. Some people love Jesus because he makes concrete this future hope of a Sabbath when the whole world is made new and made good. And he shows people what that looks like as he goes around transforming a broken world. And they marvel at him and they glorify God because of him. And other people hate Jesus for the same reasons. They hate that he offers a leg up to the moral failures, because I certainly don't need that. I've been so righteous. They hate that he works on a Saturday, transgressing their own particular bizarre interpretation of the Old Testament law, even though when it comes to their own practice on Saturday, they're complete hypocrites. Yeah, there are kind of two sides to the story, except one of them is beautiful and full of hope and mercy and forgiveness and transformation. And the other one is stubborn and self-righteous and arrogant and hypocritical. And so at the end of it, who do you side with? Now, do you side with Charles or Diana? I don't know, as you watch The Crown. Do you side with those who say the US election was rigged, or those who think Biden won? Do you side with Putin, who says this is a necessary military exercise, or with the most people in the West who think this is an evil and unprovoked war? Do you side with Jesus, who's come for the sick to bring forgiveness? Or do you side with those who reject him because of their own issues, frankly? I think it's pretty obvious, isn't it, at the end of this, that Jesus looks very beautiful and they look very ugly. Of course, that's in the first century. It's the same today, isn't it, that some people love Jesus. Other people are indifferent to Jesus. Other people despise Jesus. Are there reasons for despising him, good reasons? Or is there a kind of self-righteousness, a kind of arrogance, a kind of hypocrisy that keeps at arm's length the one who would offer them mercy and forgiveness and change? We can take a pause and then pray together.